content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the October 2023 Walter Magazine. In honor of the State Fair, we begin with On the Grounds, celebrating 170 years of the North Carolina State Fair by Joel Haas. The North Carolina State Fair has shifted sites three times. It's been suspended during wartime and for periods of tight budgets. It's been delayed by a hurricane and canceled by a pandemic. But it remains a fall fixture in North Carolina, and here in Raleigh, we claim it as our own. The fair's origins stem from the Great Exhibition of 1851 in London. This European fair offered a forum for innovators in everything from agriculture to artillery to show what they did and how they did it. Historically, these sorts of fairs had been more of an opportunity for farmers and craftsmen to gather to sell their wares. For the first time, the fair had become a place to instruct the public at large and to support and create innovation. The North Carolina Agricultural Society, formed in 1852 with the purpose of raising funds for a fair to share practices. By 1853, they'd chosen a plot to hold it, 16 acres east of the then one-square-mile town of Raleigh. Notices were sent to all the newspapers in the state, encouraging farmers to bring items to show and asking them to stay and talk about them. As exhibitors reached the fairgrounds, they shared their names and what they would demonstrate. And people came. On one of its 6 days, over 4,000 people visited the fair, a huge success by the standards of the day. The Agricultural Society erected more wooden buildings along with sheds and tents for the 1854 fair. The fair grew in size and success through 1859. In 1860, it was canceled as the state entered the Civil War, and it didn't restart until 1869, after the early years of Reconstruction. By then, the buildings were in poor shape, and the tents were gone. So in 1873, the fair moved to a new, larger area on Hillsborough Street, across from North Carolina State University's current location. In 1926, the longtime sponsor and founder of the fair, the NC Agricultural Society, was too broke to continue. The North Carolina Department of Agriculture took over responsibility, donating 200 acres at the corner of Blue Ridge Road and Hillsborough Street for a new site. Here, two large brick exhibit halls connected by an arched gate were completed in time for the 1928 fair. They still stand today as one of the entry gates. As the fair continued to grow, so did the scope of what it showcased. In 1878, a telegraph employee hooked a wire from the grandstand to an office building, allowing attendees to talk to each other using the newfangled telephone. 6 years later, electricity was first used to light the fair. In 1894, there was a photography exhibit. In 1895, chicken incubators were a main attraction. The first telecast from a new educational television station, WUNC-TV, was broadcast from the North Carolina State Fair in 1954. In 1958, staff from NC State operated an atomic reactor during the fair alongside an exhibit of nuclear science. Topical exhibits continued. In 1972, the fair sponsored the world's largest space-related education exhibit, which included the Apollo 12 command module. There was a 1995 exhibit on cyberspace about information technology. 2001 brought an exhibit on biotechnology, and 2008 focused on environmental science. In the early 1930s, the first carnival-style acts marked the start of our modern Midway. By 1939, the Midway had grown to a mile long with 50 rides. In 1949, Ferris wheels, merry-go-rounds, and daredevil motorcyclists were featured. And in 1964, the nightly fireworks were introduced. By the mid-2000s, more than 100 rides could be found on the newly expanded Midway. The fair's food has also become a form of entertainment in itself. In the early days, farmers brought preserves, cakes, and pies to be judged. The first concessions at the fair were ham biscuits, sold by the Cary United Methodist Church in 1916. Foot-long hot dogs were introduced in the 1950s, and in 1978, the NC State Food Science Club served its first ice cream. While the food and entertainment are certainly part of the appeal, The fair still is true to its origins, a celebration of farming in our state. Agricultural exhibitions such as livestock judging, home economics, and horticulture, and other farm-related divisions remain under the state's control. There are pig races, draft horse pulls, and tractor pulls. Kids can visit the petting zoo, and then go visit the animals entered to compete for prizes. Newer features include the NC Public House, showcasing local beer, wine, cider, and craft sodas, as well as a kids' decorating competition. In 2022, the fair received more than 36,000 applications for entries to its various competition categories. This year, the fair will sprawl over 344 acres, with an expected attendance of about 1 million. But should you want to go back to those 1850s origins, you can always visit the village of yesteryear, which first opened in 1950. There, you can take in heritage crafts like blacksmithing, basketry, pottery, and spinning thread by hand, and marvel at how far we've come. This article was edited for Time. Next, the Giving Garden. Preston Montague transformed his gravelly front yard into a thriving ecosystem, by Colony Little. Preston Montague first got into gardening as an art student at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. I rented a home in an eclectic college area where the people who actively gardened were punks and Quakers, he says of his neighbors. These two groups of people encouraged him to take up gardening as a hobby, which led to his career as a landscape architect. On the surface, these two communities seemed different from one another, but, he explains, they had a lot in common. Most importantly, living a mission-driven life and sharing resources with communities that have very little. They believed that gardens weren't just for aesthetics, but a place to grow food to share. The neighborhood inspired Montague to put those ideas into practice. My own yard in Greensboro was a place for people who didn't have homes to call their own, says Montague, citing a shed in his yard that occasionally served as a temporary shelter. He grew tomatoes and pepper plants in the front yard and welcomed people experiencing food insecurity to eat as they pleased. With an eye toward landscape design, fine-tuned through undergraduate study in fine art, Montague relocated to Raleigh in 2006 to pursue a degree in horticulture at NC State, an experience that he describes as, quote, "the most powerful education experience I've had," end quote. When he graduated in 2008, he discovered that there were more career opportunities in landscape architecture, so he earned a master's degree at NC State. Montague built a portfolio of landscape architecture projects, including the Raleigh City Farm, a nonprofit urban farm on Blunt Street that both sells and donates produce in the community, and Bree Arthur's Foodscapes, a diversified garden that integrates edible plants into an ornamental landscape. By fusing art and design with horticulture, Montague developed unique expertise. Ultimately, my horticulture education taught me how to look for clues, using plants to make the invisible visible, he says. Plants can tell you how the soil is composed. They can tell you how stormwater is behaving. And they can tell you if they were an appropriate choice for the environment in which you planted them. These lessons did not come easily. When he launched his solo landscape architecture practice in 2020, one of his first projects, his own front yard in Durham, where he moved that same year, was almost a complete failure. Originally, I specified lots of native plants, which I assumed would be successful because they're from this climate, he recalls. But I miscalculated the microclimate, which overruled lots of my planting decisions. Plants that were native to mountainous regions or wet habitats were not conducive to the hot climate and gritty, gravelly soil on Montague's property. It just fizzled out, he says, and within a year, it was obvious I had to reinvent the landscape. This reinvention included keeping the few plants that survived, which ironically were non-native Mediterranean herbs. What the herbs were telling me is that my landscape was dry, hot, and windy. So I began looking at environments that fit that description, he says. Montague's garden now features eastern prickly pear cacti, echinacea flowers, mangavai succulents, and lots of native herbs that better align with the microclimate. He uses mass planting, grouping large numbers of similarly shaped plants to create density and give more stability to the soil. One of the things I tell people is that often the answer to your problems is more plants, he says. By planting very densely, I crowd out weeds and negate the need for mulch. Plants are mulch. Some of the ground cover plants in his yard include fuzzy lamb's ear, pale yellow moonbeam world tickseed, early glow strawberry, and oregano. Montague maintains a detailed master plant list that organizes the 50-plus trees, shrubs, flowers, herbs, and succulents, each categorized by form, function, and aesthetic. Embracing the unique properties of his own garden taught Montague valuable lessons that he imparts to his clients. It's taken an enormous amount of time, critical thinking, and experimentation to adapt what I've learned about native ecological landscape design and maintenance to suit our climate and aesthetic differences here in the triangle, he says. Patience, priorities, and trial and error are essential elements of the process. Once I figured out which native plants would tolerate the stress of my home landscape, I was a much more successful gardener, he says. And in the long run, the retooling paid dividends to him, invaluable time. Now, the garden is so resilient, I don't have that much to do. I barely even weed or irrigate. Instead, I weed other people's gardens. For Montague, gardening is now a communal experience, both in its labor and the fruits of the labor. His garden in Durham reflects those early revelations back in Greensboro. My front yard design isn't for me, he says. It's designed for everyone else. I have boulders for people to sit on, and plums, blueberries, and strawberries for everyone to nibble on, he says. I've grown a neighborhood's worth of Mediterranean herbs so that people can make awesome spaghetti sauce. The bees, butterflies, and sparkling fireflies that all enjoy his garden are the icing on the cake. That's my favorite part of the landscape, he says. It went from desert to dessert in just a few years. This article was edited for Time. From the Nature Department, elk in our mountains. See and hear these majestic animals in North Carolina, by Mike Dunn. My first sighting of elk in the world was 40 years ago in my favorite place on earth, Yellowstone. It was June, and the countryside was green with fresh vegetation. Driving into Mammoth, the park headquarters, it seemed like a scene from a zoo rather than a national park. Cow elk and a few calves were scattered all around the buildings, lounging in the grassy areas and generally ignoring the hundreds of people swarming the hotel, shops, and visitor center. Yellowstone elk are wild, and signage, as well as park literature, warns visitors not to approach them, especially cows with calves. This experience was a decade before the reintroduction of gray wolves into the park, and driving through the rich landscape, I saw literally thousands of elk scattered throughout the open sage flats and grasslands. A few years later, I took friends on a Yellowstone adventure in September. At that time of year, the landscape was mainly brown, save for the golden aspens, and the elk were putting on a different kind of show. It was the season of the rut, when the dominant bull elk, now sporting impressive antlers, were vying for the right to mate. And that's when I heard my first elk bugle, a long, whistle-like scream followed by some low grunts. I remember thinking, that doesn't sound like something that should come out of such a massive animal. Almost 20 years later, I was leading a teacher workshop in Cataloochee Valley in Great Smoky Mountains National Park in western North Carolina. It was dawn on a cold Saturday morning, and frost crystals decorated the grasses in the meadow. A huge bull elk strutted out across the field, eyeing a small herd of cow elk nearby. The breeding season was winding down, but he was still intent on maintaining his herd. Another large bull was across the road. We watched in amazement as the dominant bull walked toward the intruder, neck outstretched, and then let out a bugle. That was the first elk bugle I heard in my home state, and it brought to mind the wildness I always feel when out west. That bugling looked different from the ones I saw in Yellowstone. He sported some elk bling, bright-colored ear tags, and a leather radio tracking collar. He was one of the first elk to be reintroduced back into their former range in our mountains, and the National Park Service was keeping a close eye on him and his friends. The workshop was in late October of 2003, 2 years after the first elk were reintroduced into the Smokies. Historically, elk were found throughout much of the East and roamed the mountains and foothills of North Carolina until their disappearance from hunting and habitat alteration. In 2001 and 2002, after decades of discussion about how to return the elk to the state, the National Park Service decided to reintroduce 52 animals from Kentucky and Manitoba, Canada, into Cataloochee Valley. More than 20 years later, our elk population now numbers around 200 animals in a large swath of public and private lands in and around the valley. Elk are one of the largest members of the deer family. In North Carolina, they're considered the largest land mammal, larger than most black bears, with bulls weighing more than 700 pounds and standing 5 feet tall at the shoulder. They're roughly 8 to 10 feet in length from nose to tail and can carry impressive antlers weighing more than 40 pounds that have spreads of 4 to 5 feet. Cows are generally smaller and don't develop antlers. They usually give birth to a single calf in May or June. Elk feed on grasses and wildflowers, as well as leaves, fruit, and twigs of shrubs and trees, and are capable of consuming up to 20 pounds of vegetation in a day. The mating season, or rut, is from September through early November, and the most dominant bulls gather herds of cows called harems for breeding. Bulls spend much of their efforts gathering the cows and warding off potential rival males, and bugling is another important part of that ritual. If another male is determined and seemingly equally matched, a struggle may ensue, with the bulls lowering their heads and locking antlers in a sparring match. These battles occasionally result in injuries to one or both combatants, but more often, the lesser bull retreats to try again another day. Cows and calves remain in a herd throughout much of the year, but often isolate themselves to give birth. They rejoin the herd once the calf is able to keep up at about 2 weeks of age. There are several good places to view elk in our mountains: Cataloochee Valley, up on the Blue Ridge Parkway near Cataloochee, the nearby town of Maggie Valley, and the land of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians near Cherokee. The best viewing times are generally early or late in the day. Fall is a great time for elk viewing because they gather in large groups for the rut. If you go see the elk, please observe responsibly and obey the rules. Elk are large animals and can be dangerous, especially during the rut or when calves are present. I applaud the many agencies and individuals that have worked so hard to bring back this important piece of wildness to our state. And I encourage you to make the trip to see and hear these majestic animals. This article was edited for Time. And lastly, we have Creative Pursuits, Daniel and Susan Woodard Kelly's Airy Handmade Home by Addie Ladner. Every component of Daniel and Susan Woodard Kelly's home comes with a story, from the objects on display to the furniture to the structure itself. The original house in Capitol Heights, just under 1,000 square feet, was built in the 1940s using wood from an old tobacco barn. In the bathroom, jars are filled with shells collected around the world. In a child's bedroom, fabric bird cages crafted by an artist friend hang from a mobile that Susan made. There's furniture Daniel made from Pekki cypress collected by Susan's dad. Daniel highlighted the wood's signature burrows by filling them with white resin. Daniel first moved into this house as a renter in 2005 after graduating from North Carolina State University, where he studied art and design. He purchased the house in 2007 while working at the architecture firm Clearscapes, but soon rented it out to head to New Orleans for an artist residency. There he reconnected with Susan, a Mississippi Delta native, who happened to have gone to summer camp in North Carolina with Daniel's sister. Susan had studied art at Louisiana State University, received her master's from University of Mississippi, and worked in floral design in New York City before returning to the area. The two stayed in Louisiana for 7 years, married, and had 2 children. In 2016, they moved back to North Carolina. They lived with Daniel's parents in Carthage for 6 months while updating this home themselves to suit their family. The main priority of the renovation was to make the space feel more open and bright. They tore down walls and removed doors to create a living area with a studio for Susan, a living room, dining area, and kitchen. They gutted the kitchen, painted the walls white, and replaced the floors with a gray-washed pine. Daniel created renderings for a 300-square-foot primary suite addition to the home. While the home is technically finished, we're always working on something, Susan laughs. Daniel agrees, it's constantly evolving. We're always changing up the art, reconfiguring the spaces, fixing an old piece of wood on the front. We've removed walls, added walls, constantly pushing and pulling. Today, both work as full-time artists. Susan is known for her watercolors, and Daniel creates architecturally inspired fine art. Their walls are filled with their own work and pieces from fellow artists. Found objects and family heirlooms accent the home. It's cozy, curated, and handmade, a space that shifts with the seasons as their kids grow and as the couple evolve as artists and humans. It's an ongoing experience that's expressive of how we live, says Daniel. This article was edited for Time. That's all for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.